This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
This is off her first record. Most people don't own it.
32 years ago today, Nirvana recorded this. 14 songs in one take, live on MTV Unplugged. And it was just 5 months before Kurt Cobain died. It's still been hailed as one of the greatest live albums and performances ever, capturing a raw and an exposed Nirvana. So, 32 years on, did you watch this? Can you remember this MTV Unplugged moment? Or maybe there was another Nirvana moment. Did you see them at Big Day Out? Did you see them on Rage? Was there a time when you heard one of their songs? Did they change music and did they change fashion for you? 1-300-222-774. And also later this hour, as a woman, does it drive you crazy when you're told to smile? Mikey Carl, of course, you might know him as DJ Joey Lightbulb. He's also a writer and writer for Beat magazine. I just can't believe it's been 32 years. Mikey, how does that happen?
I've been having fun. That's what it is.
Time does fly. Why is this still held up as such an incredible performance? Is it because they were unplugged and for such a normally grungy, loud, banging, you know, band to see them so stripped back and raw?
I think that's a huge reason. I think I don't think anyone knew they really had it in them to the extent where they could just pull it all back and deliver. I mean, the catharsis you can hear through this, and you know, I'm immediately connected to Year 12 camp. On the way to Year 12 camp, and we listened to the Pulp Fiction soundtrack and we listened to this, and you know, people, as much as they're excited to go in Year 12 camp, it was kind of became hushed quite often on the bus because, you know, like, what's this David Bowie song? I've never heard this David Bowie song. And just moment after moment where Kurt just goes to these places that, you know, he's not in a good way during this season. He's being funny, he's being self-deprecating, and he's, you know, what are they tuning a harp, throwing a few little zingers in there. But I don't think he came off stage punching the air. He actually thought he stuffed it up, to be honest.
It was incredible to watch not just Kurt Cobain be so stripped back, but to even watch Dave Grohl on drums, someone who normally smashes those skins like nobody else, to see him with this little soft touch. And he's so young, you know, his hair's all tied back and he looks all neat.
He actually looks like when he parodies himself as a girl in Learn to Fly film clip for Foo Fighters, he actually looks like that. He's ahead of his time. To your point, you know, to see them all just so restrained, you know, there's a chalice playing, and not many people know this, but they kind of flouted the rules a little in that Kurt went through an amp, and so they kind of disguised it, so it wasn't quite unplugged. I think that just,
he had an amp hidden in the back, didn't he?
Yeah, which I think it's a great call. It just gave it a little bit more grunt because you needed a little bit of something. I've been listening to it all morning, and I'm struck by how sort of generous it is. You know, they covers the Meat Puppets, does Lake of Fire, does, you know, Lead Belly song, obviously the Bowie moment. So he's so generous in sort of giving these other artists, you know, shining the light on them, and also pulling back on any of their big singles, apart from Come As You Are. There was, as you might know, Rochelle, there was some arm wrestles backstage about whether they would do their singles.
I know, and the Teen Spirit, and if you were to do that unplugged, and I think that was an absolute no. Stay with us, Mikey. Helen's in Pakenham. Morning.
Good morning.
Can you remember watching Nirvana unplugged on MTV 32 years ago, Helen?
I can. I'd grown to love Nirvana I didn't watch it at the time, but I grew to love Nirvana because my 10-year-old son was into it. We went to Darwin and had it on repeat. But then when I saw the MTV, I thought, my God, the rawness and the passion that was conveyed with his singing. So gentle at the same time.
I know, Helen. I thought the same thing this morning, and that, and his eyes, and he was so young, and he could actually sing too. It wasn't just about screaming. But I also wonder, given that now we know with hindsight that 5 months later Kurt Cobain would be dead, whether or not that has changed the influence of that particular MTV Unplugged series, Mikey?
Yeah, I think it cements it. It just sort of takes it to that higher level. You know, I think even he said death is a career move. I think he made he made reference to it at one stage. It's pretty sardonic. And quoting Neil Young, it's better to burn out than fade away. So I think, too, before that, Eric Clapton had done a really good unplug. There'd been some so-so ones. Poison did one. No one talks about the Poison Unplugged.
I'm going to have to go and watch that. Poison Unplugged. You know what? I'm there for that. Chelsea's in Pasco Vale. Hi, Chelsea.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Really well. 32 years ago, Nirvana Unplugged. Can you remember it?
I do. I do. And I sort of have two main memories of Nirvana. The first one was I was down at the beach with my we were camping with some families. My friend Scott Thorburn, who's now a bass player in Melbourne, we were both in our teens, and he sat me down and said, Chelsea, you have to listen to this. I know you love music. You have to listen to this. And he put a cassette tape in a tape player, and it was Nirvana. It was probably, is Bleach their first album? It was, or maybe it was Smells Like Teen Spirit. And he said, you have to listen to this. And I remember thinking, I don't quite understand what I'm listening to, but I feel like it's really important and it matters. Mm. And I'll never forget it. And the second thing I remember about Nirvana and Unplugged in particular was it was just after Kurt had died, and I just finished first year uni, and I was really feeling a bit lost about where I was going and what I was doing. And I went and backpacked up the coast and collected a friend of mine, Shelley, in Newcastle, and we drove from Newcastle to Kempsey to visit her parents and then to Brisbane, and we listened to Unplugged the whole way up. And I remember hearing the feeling in his voice and hearing the skill and the choice of songs as well. Mm. And that whole drive, I thought, now I think I get it. Like, I was more into the Angry Women bands. I was into the Bikini Kill and the Riot Girls and Liz Phair and the Breeders. And L7, I still love L7. But that was when I got Nirvana, and I remember it so well, yeah.
It's interesting, Chelsea, that you say this felt important. And I kid you not, the other, like maybe a week ago, my husband, my daughter and I, we were at Bunnings and, oh no, it was a lighting store that also starts with B. And the song came on, it was a key Nirvana song. And my husband and I just stood there and we said to my daughter, you've got to listen to this. This is such an important piece of music. And it's hard to imagine at the time that they realised that they were that important, and some people even texting in saying, oh, it's just overrated garbage. And I couldn't disagree more. You don't have to love them, but you can also understand, like you said, Chelsea, you just kind of recognised that it was important. What do you mean by that?
I remember the feeling that my friend Scott had as a young man, going, and it was different to punk. It was something much more personal, and it was less angry, but it was much more emotional to the person. There was something about the fuzzy chords and the grungy chords that were very moody that I think was quite different to punk. And and I think that was what he was feeling. So there was this sort of, it was a deeper feeling from what they'd heard before. And it was less commercial than like the stuff that we'd grown up with was sort of Gunners and things. And so with Nirvana and then Pearl Jam as well, which was a bit more outward looking. I saw them last year and still love them. Or maybe it was earlier this year. But, yeah,
I think good on you, Chelsea.
really personal.
I agree, yeah. And I've got such a strong image, Chelsea, of you, you know, driving with your friend Shelley, you know, to Newcastle and listening to that Unplugged album. Mikey Carl is with you. You might know him as DJ Joey Lightbulb, a music writer, writes for Beat Magazine, amongst many others. Mikey, the Unplugged series, it's something that doesn't exist anymore. Triple J does a version. But even just watching music videos, right, whether it be Rage, MTV, even video hits, that idea of plonking yourself in the lounge room early in the morning, late at night, whatever it be, not streaming something by choice but sitting there and waiting to be taken on a journey and that moment of surprise. I feel sad that that ritual is lost.
Yeah, I mean, thank God we still have Rage. Keep funding the ABC, everybody, please. I recall actually looking up the Green Guide and seeing that they would be showing the Unplugged before Rage came on. They would show like Lauryn Hill Unplugged tonight or Nirvana Unplugged tonight. Before Rage came on, you would get to watch it, you know, 40 minutes of it. It'd be slightly abridged, but you still get a good 30 or 40 minutes of it. And that's sort of very sacred kind of moment. And also just holding a CD and when that Nirvana Unplugged came out, I can still remember it and just sort of passing it around. It's such an important tactile thing that without sounding, you know, too nostalgic, it's a beautiful thing. And we don't have that as much anymore. And the CDs will make a comeback. And, you know, I've got friends that work at CD stores.
CDs will make a comeback?
Absolutely. I've got a buddy that works at Red Eye Records in Sydney and he goes, we still sell heaps of CDs. So
really?
I know. It's kind of surprising, but, you know.
Do people even have CD players?
Yeah. And everything comes back.
I'm going to bust out my double-sided CD player. Hey, let's have a chat to Alison, who's in Blackburn. Hi, Alison.
Oh, hi there.
In Seattle, there's a museum that shows this. Is that right?
In Seattle, I don't know the name of the museum. It's probably popular culture. You can sit and watch an entire performance of Nirvana, which I've done. And the other amazing thing it has is other artists from there, like it has Jimi Hendrix's airline bag. Like airline bags, I think, were things from the 60s and 70s. Like it's a white bag with red or black writing, and it has his notes that he wrote on a notepad he got from the plane. Notes for music and his lyrics. So it's a great museum. I didn't know about it before I went, and they've got a
video of Nirvana and that particular performance, which was incredible. Good on you, Alison. Thank you. Just finally, Mikey, I guess the other thing that's incredible about this and reflecting back on this performance and album 32 years later is there was a lot of toing and froing to even get them to do it, whether it be with management, with MTV, with Kurt himself. It was recorded 14 songs in one take.
Astounding. It's absolutely astounding. And you can hear his voice crack a few times and, you know, in Lake of Fire. And even I think I was going to say, when he sings Tell Me Where Did You Sleep Last Night, the passion and the actual intent and, he's probably thinking about Courtney Love at that stage. They were very on again, off again, a very tumultuous relationship. So just poured everything into it, and kudos to them for standing their ground and saying, no, we're not going to do some kind of cheesy teen spirit unplugged version. You know, we're going to do it our way. And that's why, Liz, it actually, without being too hyperbolic, it changed the course of modern music because it showed this rock band could be very effeminate and very vulnerable and more powerful. You know,
well, I went down a very enjoyable rabbit hole listening to this and watching this today. You are welcome, Mikey. Mikey Carl, aka DJ Joey Lightbulb and writer for Beat Magazine. 32 years ago today, MTV Unplugged. This was recorded. 14 songs in one take. And just 5 months later, Kurt Cobain had died. Maybe that's a part of the reason why we remember it so much.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
CDs are alive and well, apparently. How dare I say I don't think people still listen to CDs. Do people still listen to CDs? Damn right they do, says this text. And another, Rish, for heaven's sakes, CDs still sell very well. One of the biggest formats on eBay and Amazon. And they still make up for car tapes, CDs, and for road trips as well. Well, there you have it. I've learnt something new today. Keep your reflections of Nirvana and that MTV Unplugged gig coming through. We'll try and get back to them a little later in the program. Our number's 1-300-222-774. But no doubt all morning, as you've been hearing, MP Jess Wilson will now or has now been elected to lead the Victorian Liberal Party. She is now the first woman to lead the coalition in the state's history. And she's a millennial. She's 35 years old. So over the next year, as we lead into that next election, will this kind of become a battle of the generations? We've got a millennial versus a Gen X. And given when we look at the number of young voters and millennials now outnumbering the number of boomers, if we're going to look at generations, will we find younger voters, millennials, looking at voting for someone based on age and understanding as opposed to aligning themselves with a political party? If you're a millennial or if your child is a millennial, what did they make of today's news? 1-300-222-774. Catherine Ellis is the CEO of Leadership Victoria, formerly the CEO of Youth Affairs Council. Catherine, we know that younger voters already feel a little bit forgotten on anything from being able to own a house to climate change. Putting what party someone is with aside, will Jess win votes purely just because she's young?
It's a big question. I think it won't be so much about winning votes just because she's young. I think it'll be more about being a fresh face and maybe someone who's speaking differently about issues and thinking differently about issues than her predecessors. So I think in that case, she may be very attractive to young voters. Particularly, you know, so many young people have lost trust in institutions these days. And you can see in the US with Zora Mandani in New York and Katie Wilson, who's just been elected the mayor of Seattle, they're young, fresh faces. But the difference, of course, there is that they're social democrats who are saying the system's not fair to young people and we need to change that. So I think the big question for Jess Wilson will be her policy situation, her policy views. Yeah.
The text line on is obviously, as Raf's been covering it all throughout the morning, the text line in one way or another was talking about inexperience as being an issue. You can only have so much experience at a certain age. Do you think that's an issue in particular for younger voters?
I don't think that's going to be an issue at all, to be honest. And 35 is actually not that young anyway.
Yeah.
And particularly to young people, became the CEO of the Reach Foundation when I was 34, and all the young people there thought I was ancient. So I think for Gen Z particularly, they will see her as someone who has, you know, pretty significant experience. And you've got to remember, you know, they don't operate alone. They've all got teams behind them. So I think part of it also will be about how well does she lead the team in her party to be able to have a really sort of unified position on issues that young people care about. And that's going to be the biggest thing, because young people tend to not align themselves with parties.
No, that's what I find interesting. Yeah. That's what I wondered. I thought, because the alignment with a party when for younger voters isn't as strong as older generations, I'm not saying one is right or wrong, far from it. I do find it interesting that all of a sudden you have a leader who is young, and purely by age and age as an association, there may be... Well, she understands me, she gets what I'm going through, because there has been a generational divide. I mean, this text that says the sexism and misogyny has already started with people comparing the age differences between both leaders. One is young and spirited, the other is older. It's disappointing on this conversation. And I honestly, hand on heart, do not mean it like that. As a Gen Xer myself, I love the idea that there are two women now leading both parties. I guess what I'm trying to get to
That's
is that...
interesting, actually, because I thought that would actually take the misogyny out of it, because it's women competing against each other. Interesting. Anyway, sorry, go on.
No, well, I guess I've done countless shows on why young people feel unheard and forgotten, and I just wonder whether this will be a strength for Jess, or it will just change how young people vote, or if they vote at all.
I think that's the key to it. It'll be about not so much her being young, but being a fresh new face who is not necessarily already embedded and imbued with all of the existing positions of either party, because the reality is young people feel like they've been left behind, and they feel like the issues that they care about and that are affecting their lives now and into the future are not being treated as important as some of the other things that they don't really care so much about. And of course, cost of living and housing and climate are the top three in those. But there's a real sort of level, feeling of intergenerational unfairness, I think, as well. And then that goes into the space of mental health as well. And I think actually a lot of young people are very passionate about First Nations issues. So the fact that the Liberals have said they're going to dump treaty, which would be a tragedy, honestly, is going to potentially factor in as well. So
yeah.
I don't think she'll be able to rely on her youth. She needs to be able to show that her youth is bringing a different perspective on issues that affect young people than what's gone before.
The idea that she is a young woman going up against an older woman, I would hate for this to become a woman versus woman, you know, a female sort of attacking another. I mean, there's already texts coming in saying she's going to have a tough time with the baby. I know Jacinda Ardern, when you look at her book and what she's been speaking about and female leaders and what people focus on. Are you concerned in any way that this will become a woman versus woman issue down the track, Catherine?
I think there's a lot of evidence now that women are absolutely capable of being significant leaders at the same time as having small children. And I think particularly younger generations, they get a lot more help from their partners, excuse me, in a lot of cases. And you've only got to look at federal labour, where people have had babies and all sorts of family situations at the same time as bringing in really significant policy shifts and progress. So I think that if it becomes a female versus female thing, it's going to be being whipped up by people who are trying to exploit the misogyny that exists in our community. And so it'll be up to the media, it'll be up to the parties themselves to really stand against that at every moment. And I don't think that young people will like that or want that either. And actually, I really wonder with Jacinda Allen too, you know, she was a very young minister herself,
yeah.
So she knows what it's like to be a young woman in politics. So I don't think she will try and exploit that in ways that would be misogynistic. I think that, I really hope it'll be a fair fight between the two of them as leaders who have the trust of their parties and have pretty different perspectives.
It's going to be interesting to watch it play out, isn't it? And interestingly, we're speaking to Jane Carrow in just a moment on another issue, who is a very outspoken feminist. Cool. But it's going to be interesting to watch the next year leading up to the next election, how it is played differently between two women versus two men, whether it be by the women themselves, by the public, or by the media. You hope at some point gender gets put aside, but I wonder whether it will feel, look and sound different.
It's going to be really interesting to see. And I really think a lot of it is going to be about what the community, what the public are willing to accept on that front. So if it's being whipped up by certain people who think they can exploit it and people are buying into it, then yes, it will become that kind of fight. But if it's very clear that people don't accept that anymore in a modern society, then I hope that we can actually step above that and recognise leaders for what they bring in terms of adaptability and the willingness and ability to handle complexity and work collectively. And actually, you know, what young people are really looking for in leaders these days is authenticity and people who really genuinely care. And that's what I really hope that this election will show, is that we have, you know, a choice between leaders who really care about Victoria and really care about young people in Victoria. And that, I think, is what will resonate with young people if they can see that that's what's coming down the line for them.
The other thing, and just finally, Catherine Ellis is the CEO of Leadership Victoria, the former CEO of Youth Affairs Council. Climate, we know, is a really big issue for young voters. So if we are sort of looking at age of people who aren't politically aligned to one party, they see a millennial coming in and think, okay, maybe she gets me, maybe she understands. However, I'm not happy with their stance on climate. How does Jess balance that?
It's an interesting question. I think a lot of people see climate as a federal issue, and so it's going to be an interesting challenge for the Labor government to demonstrate what they have been doing on climate and energy. And I was actually surprised myself to find out how much was happening that they don't really even talk about. So I think that for Jess Wilson to be thinking at a policy level, at a state level, what can we be doing to address climate will be incredibly important, because young people definitely do care about climate, even though it doesn't get discussed as much these days, because it is about their future. And then they really have a very serious fear for the future, a lot of them, even down to not wanting to have children or wondering whether it's worth, you know, going to university and getting a degree because they won't have jobs and a career worth that, you know. So I think thinking constantly about what do young people want now and what do young people want for the future is going to be absolutely the key to engaging them in thinking about voting for you, whether you're Jacinta or you're Jeff.
Yeah, well, this text, age doesn't matter. There are many young politicians with old ideas. The issue in Australia is both parties are really removed from how ordinary people live and speak, people just like us, both advocates for the status quo. Always good to get your thoughts on this, Catherine. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks.
Catherine Ellis, the CEO of Leadership Victoria and the former CEO of the Youth Affairs Council. My name's Rochelle. This is The Conversation Hour. If you've just joined us at the top of the program, we were talking about Nirvana 32 years ago today. They recorded their MTV Unplugged album, that live performance, 14 songs in one take. Lots of you just reminiscing on actually watching that particular moment, watching that particular night. This listening to the beginning of your Nirvana conversation gave me both body chills and goosebumps. Nothing changed my life as much as the music of Nirvana and Kurt Cobain's death. I watched the Unplugged session on Rage hundreds of times. Then I bought the VHS. This topic is well worth bringing up. Thank you. I've had to stop working so that I can listen in. Oh, I love that. I know. Wait till you watch The Vision and go back down. Even 30 years since Kurt's death, my life is still influenced by Nirvana. Peace, love, and empathy. And this, Nirvana will last forever, both musically and lyrically, never to be replicated. They are legends now, and they will stand the test of time.
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Smile, though your heart is aching. Smile, even though it's breaking. When there are clouds in the sky, you'll get by if you smile through.
So why are women told to smile? Have you ever been told to smile? Have you seen some of the vision going around of the huge megastar, Millie Bobby Brown? She, of course, is one of the stars of Stranger Things. So she was on the red carpet while she was attending the London premiere of Stranger Things, and a photographer yelled out to her to smile. She kept saying, smile, smile. And Millie snapped back and said, smile, you smile, and then stormed off. And I can remember once walking down the street. I was probably only about 16 or 17 at the time. And I was told by a complete stranger who walked past me and said, smile, love. Come on, things mustn't be that bad. So why are women told to smile? And then if you don't smile, then you're known as having, you know, resting bitch face. And are men told to smile in the same way? And what has Millie Bobby Brown highlighted? Is it something that's just been going on for generations? Jane Caro, novelist, social commentator. Jane, I love everything about Millie Bobby Brown. She's only 21 years old. She's so comfortable in her own skin and telling people what she thinks, and not sticking with the way people expect a Hollywood star to be, and to snap back at the photographer, "You smile." Mm. Why are we told to smile so much?
Because we're meant to be placatory. Women have to go through life placating and making other people feel better. And so when we smile, and particularly when we obey the order to smile, because if you think about it, come on, love, smile. Mm. Give us a smile, love. Oh, it can't be that bad, you know. A cheer up, all of that. That's not about making you feel better. That's about making the person who's saying it feel better and also feel powerful. Because if we react the way we're, certainly my generation was brought up to react, which is to smile on command and to hide any serious thoughts we might be having, because we might not be unhappy. We might be actually, you know, working something out in our head, or, you know, just being part of the environment and not thinking about what our face is doing. We're suddenly brought back to the realization, oh, no, Dale, you're not just a human being walking down the road minding her own business. You're a woman. Therefore, you have to behave in the way that we men and us, society at large, the patriarchy, want you to behave. Don't you forget that, no matter where you are. Don't you get caught up in your own thoughts or your own just existing in the world. Be reminded constantly you're a woman. Everyone who is in a subordinate group, subordinate culture group, and that's basically everyone except privileged white straight men, we are, particularly now that I've gotten older, I've really come across this thing about being reminded of my age all the time. So even though it might be kind of sound like it's meant kindly, you know, and what does this cute little thing want?
Yeah.
You know, when I'm
and
a 68-year-old woman, reminded, you're old. Well, I'm just existing. I'm not thinking about my age. Stop reminding me of it.
And the term resting bitch face is only a relatively new one. And that's almost, when you start to think about it, it's a retaliation to the women who don't just say, okay, well, I'm just going to please you. I'm going to be a people pleaser. I'm going to smile. Even though, right? I don't have to smile all the time. Doesn't mean I'm unhappy. Just means I'm going about my business.
It just means I'm existing and how my face is has absolutely nothing to do with you. I mean, I understand if you're in a relationship with somebody and they look at you and they think you might look sad, they'd say to you,
what's wrong? Yeah.
What's wrong? But they wouldn't say to you, smile.
The amount of people, Jane, that are saying that, because it happened to me by a random stranger years ago. I'll never forget it. I was walking in the main street of Warrigal in regional Victoria. I was on my way to a theatre rehearsal, and some random stranger asked me to smile, and I was so taken aback. And now there's text now saying, in my younger days, back in the 90s and 2000s, I remember being told to smile by random men in the street on a regular basis. I was always too shocked to reply. If that happened now, these men wouldn't know what's coming. And that's from Alison in McLeod. And I agree. And what I love is that you and I now, Jane Caro, like Alison, would probably snap back and be like, say exactly what Millie Bobby Brown said at the age of 21. You smile. And I love that at 21, she's not just taking it on the chin like we did.
Yes. I think that's one of the great triumphs, actually, of feminism, is that it has really changed the way women think about themselves, the way women think about themselves in society. There is a view that we can take up space, that we can be ourselves, that we don't have to go through life placating the men around us. And that was just a survival tactic. We did that because the kind of response we got if we didn't was so vicious and hard and difficult that we protected ourselves from it by being placatory. I mean, I've heard from some quite famous women who've written memoirs and things about their lives, and one of the things they often talk about is how their mothers tried to get them not to stand out, not to, you know, stop placating, and how disappointed they were in their mothers about that. But I often thought, yes, but your mother is frightened for you. She's frightened of the reaction you're going to get if you don't do the feather smoothing that generations of women
for thousands of years have been brought up to do because we're subordinate culture.
And maybe that's what's changing, though.
Dominant.
That's what I hope is changing. Like Jess has just sent this and it says, Rish, I've never forgotten being told to smile by someone while working at an optometrist's when I was in my mid-teens. I had to get new glasses with my mum. I wasn't very enthused. I was completely mortified. And of course, it did not encourage me to smile. I am now so cross about it on behalf of my teen me and all females. So us looking back, we're angry that we did put up with it. I wonder, though, whether the generation, the Millie Bobby Brown generation, aren't putting up with it.
I hope they're not, and I think a lot of them aren't. But I would say this, Millie Bobby Brown is a movie star. She has a lot of personal power, influence and clout, and therefore she has a certain confidence that perhaps a lot of young girls still don't have. And, you know, young women are at the lowest order of the pecking order in our society. I mean, just look at some of the rhetoric we're hearing about the young women in the Epstein files, for example, who were, there's now debate about whether a 15-year-old is a child. You know, and therefore, is she fair game for grown men with power? I mean, it's extraordinary. So I do worry that the vulnerability is still there, and that is because the attitude that young women are somehow only existing to please men because they're pretty little things still remains.
Thank you, as always, Jane. Jane Caro, novelist, social commentator. Lots of us now going, yeah, actually, hang on a second. Why was I told to smile so often by random people? Oh, Rochelle says this. I can't tell you how often this has happened to me. Why do strangers think they have a right to tell me how to look? Next time, I will tell them what I'm dealing with and then I'll just be called grumpy. Women can't win. That's from Sue. Sue, you are so right. The moment you don't smile, you have a resting bitch face. Or the moment you say you smile like Millie Bobby Brown, then you're labelled as a difficult woman. So we can't win. So here's the thing, right? Just do whatever feels right to you. Keep those texts, keep those calls coming through. We've also been talking about Nirvana 32 years ago today. They recorded that incredible moment on MTV Unplugged, 14 songs in one take. Glenn's in Baxter. G'day, Glenn. Have I taken you down a Nirvana wormhole?
G'day, Rochelle. Yeah, you sure have. I can't believe it's been 32 years for a start. I can still see my peroxide blonde fringe, which is real march backwards, shall we say. But I was just taken aback a bit there. A couple of your listeners were sort of saying that it was overrated rubbish, and I think they just probably just don't get the whole Nirvana thing. I mean, most musicians and artists that we know tend to sort of have a bit of a troubled background, which flows under their creativity, and unfortunately for Kurt Cobain, but good for us, I suppose, we got the great music. He really was a troubled soul, and if they actually took time to read his lyrics, and it was almost a form of poetry, and I think also that then transferred onto the Unplugged event, where the stage itself was absolutely magnificent. It was all lilies and dark colours and hues. It was quite artistic, which Kurt Cobain was, and I get sad because I think if he was alive today, it'd be amazing the music he would still be producing. I think he was definitely a pioneer in that music, and he spoke to a generation of kids that were feeling like him and were probably feeling unheard. So yeah,
and it was amazing, Glenn, to go back and watch the footage and just to see, well, all of them, you know, Dave Grohl included, but Kurt Cobain in particular, given that 5 months later, you know, he would no longer walk the earth, and to see how young he was, to be able to look into his eyes almost, because the camera was so close and he was so still and everything about it was so still, which is so rare for Nirvana. It was kind of spooky to watch, I have to say.
Yeah, it was, and I mean, if you really want to see an artist that was putting his heart and soul into his music, that performance, his guttural screams and his mannerisms were incredible. I mean, for a three-piece outfit, they were so in sync with each other, and it just came so naturally. There was nothing contrived about it. They were just one out of the box at the time, and it was a great loss. And I still, every time I put their music on, it. Yeah, of my French comes back and I'm moving.
Your French comes back. A little bit of tone, a little bit of magic silver whites to brush it out. Good on you, Glenn. Lovely to go down that memory lane with you. My name's Rochelle. This is The Conversation Hour. So if you play cricket, how's your local cricket club going at the moment? I know from Nirvana to cricket, we do that on The Convo Hour. But if you play cricket, whether your kids play cricket, what are your numbers like? Can you see that next generation coming through? Have you got a mix of ages and of genders, and can you see its future? So one local club is making sure that cricket stays in the spotlight, and 774's own station reporter Kate Mead has made her way down to Donnybrook. You may or may not be in your cricket whites, even though I don't think you have to wear white to play cricket anymore, Kate, but there is a local club and a local school trying to get themselves into the Guinness Book of Records to make sure that cricket stays relevant. Kate, what's happening where you are?
Well, in terms of keeping cricket relevant, I am right bang in the middle of the Donnybrook Reserve, which is both a cricket ground and a football ground. It was built in only 2022, and this year has been the first time in the juniors that they have been able to field a football team and their cricket. So very exciting. There is 1,131 students aged between 6 and 14 playing on this ground. I'm certain I'm going to catch a ball.
Make sure you're not in the middle there, Kate. Be careful.
I'm kind of in the middle, and they're on their last exercise for the world record attempt. So it's basically to do a training session or a lesson with the most amount of people. Now, interestingly, this has been timed to steal it from the Lords Cricket Club. Now, they just got this world record in the middle of this year. Australia now is stealing it back so that they have it in time for the Ashes. But if you're talking about what does the future look like for cricket, I can't think of a better way to encourage kids to participate than what I'm seeing right now.
And that's the reason why they're doing it, is to try and just throw a spotlight onto the importance of cricket, but of community sport in general. So the story is not just about trying to get into the Guinness Book of Records. It's about ensuring that cricket remains a viable and energetic sport in local clubs and in local suburbs.
And the extension to that, Rochelle, I spoke to Jason, who is the president of the Donnybrook Dragons, and he just said our kids need somewhere to go. This is a brand new community that is building and growing at such a fast pace, and we need to make sure that we have programs for them. And when you see 1,000+ kids on the oval here like I am right now, you see what an incredible job they are doing.
I'm a little bit worried for you, Kate. Well, you're talented. I mean, I could imagine you out there behind the wicket. So what time has it been announced yet? What time will the world record be announced?
You know what? We are moments away from that actually happening. So the class will finish, I'd say, in the next 5 minutes maybe, and then the officials step in. The official counting has to take place. There is the world record judges here. There's all the officials. Yep, I'm going to cop a ball.
Oh, my God.
So I'd say just after you finish, Rochelle, I will be able to report back, maybe for afternoons with Bridget, to let them know if this world record attempt has been completed.
All right, okay, go get yourself somewhere safe and find yourself a sandwich or something.
We're still only throwing tennis balls, that's all.
All right, good. Yeah, you don't want to cop a cricket ball in the shins.
Not that good.
Kate Mead, 774 ABC Radio Melbourne station reporter, down at Donnybrook, just mere minutes away from where that world record of about 1,200 players, cricket players, all uniting, all about trying to celebrate local cricket. So just minutes away from that world record being announced. We've been talking about Nirvana 32 years ago today. That album, that MTV Unplugged album, was recorded, but it was 1992, I think, the big day out where Nirvana played. Andrew Mast, music writer. Masty, you saw Nirvana play. Was it at that big day out?
No, I was at the Palace in St Kilda many, many years before it was torn down. They did three shows there back to back, and I went to the first one on January 31. Yes, and it was amazing.
So different, I could imagine, to the MTV Unplugged gig. It would have been the antithesis of that.
It was, and I don't go to many metal gigs, or I hadn't gone to many metal gigs at that time, so the whole idea of being in the middle of a, squashed into the centre of a room with a lot of people with long hair flicking their sweaty hair in my face was a whole new experience for me.
So, Andrew, throughout the 90s, you know, working in street press, when we saw Nirvana burst onto the scene with their style of music, people have been reflecting today about just how important Kurt Cobain and Nirvana have been for them musically and what his lyrics meant to them. What did you witness when you were writing about it, when you were seeing this artist all of a sudden come in who was just so different? You know, grunge, they created grunge almost.
Yes, yes. And they were actually influenced by the Australian post-punk, what we called the swamp scene at the time. So Australia was very, very open to what Nirvana had. But the reason I got to see them at the Palace is because they were booked before they blew up. And so they had they been booked later,
they wouldn't have got them.
Yeah, they would have had to play a bigger
venue. At least they honoured it. That's very nice of them.
they did. Well, hey, they were a nice group to work with, supposedly. Unfortunately, Cobain hadn't been well before the Melbourne show. People weren't even sure if he was going to go ahead. There were rumours that he'd OD. He did not speak. That's one of the things I remember from the show. But he just oozed so much charisma, it didn't matter. I just left going, I've seen one of the greatest shows of my life that I'm going to remember forever, and I have.
Wow. The idea of Unplugged as well, I mean, I know Triple J sort of have their version, so to speak, but the MTV Unplugged series, it was so amazing to watch bands do something different, be in the moment, and to see a different side of them. And I think Nirvana, it brought out not the best in them, but it just brought out a side that I think for a lot of people, they went, oh, okay, I get it now.
Yes, yes. And that was the thing about Nirvana is it was such a seismic shift, both them and Unplugged, that they reached people that weren't even necessarily into that kind of music. You know, club people went to see it, pop people went to see them. They just spoke to a whole generation, and you've got to give kudos to MTV because Unplugged, it's still something that people try to do now. It's, you know, you look at the tiny desk, that NPR that's so big on YouTube. This all, you know, goes back to those days of MTV coming up with this great idea of showing a different side of a band, and Nirvana was the leading one, I guess, for that.
Absolutely. Thank you, Andrew. Andrew Mast, music writer. Neil Griffiths is the editor of Rolling Stone Australia and New Zealand. It's been wonderful, Neil, just today going back to that moment of, you know, maybe hearing them for the first time, the emotion that for many of us felt hearing music like that, seeing music like Nirvana. What was it about them, do you think?
It's so interesting. I mean, I'm a millennial, so my introduction to Nirvana, I knew Foo Fighters before Nirvana, and then, you know, my older brother shows me clips of the front end of the Foo Fighters.
Like, what the hell is Dave Grohl doing there?
Exactly. It was news to me, but, you know, like so many people before, you watch Kurt Cobain and you're instantly mesmerized. And it's very interesting because when you think of some of the most iconic front men, or lead singers in the world, the Michael Jacksons, the Freddie Mercurys, the David Bowies, they're such charismatic people who, you know, they own the spotlight. Kurt Cobain was the exact opposite of that. And even thinking to this MTV Unplugged performance, you know, the reports in the lead up to this recording, he was nervous, he was suffering from drug withdrawal. So he really, from all reports, was very difficult to be around. He was butting heads with producers because they didn't want him to do so many different covers in the set. And yet then you see the performance and it is such a polished, incredible display. And I think it would turn any casual fan into a serious Nirvana fan.
I think that's what happened is a lot of people went, oh, okay, I understand now. And you heard the lyrics, you could see the sensitivity and the rawness, you could actually hear that he could sing as well. And given it just felt so personal, did you enjoy it when you were shown it for the first time, Neil?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and truly, that was the first experience I had of Nirvana outside of, seeing the standard, I guess it would be Smells Like Teen Spirit film clip you would have seen. That was the first time I saw them live. And you know, as someone who hadn't heard much of them at 6, 7 years old, there is a distinct difference between seeing the Smells Like Teen Spirit film clip and then seeing that live performance. You know, a lot of people considered that Unplugged performance, they could have gone into a whole new genre if they wanted to. They could have gone into folk rock if they wanted to. It was just an incredible performance.
Thank you. Good to get your thoughts on that, Neil. Neil Griffiths, the editor of Rolling Stone Australia and New Zealand, talking about discovering Nirvana for the first time and wondering why on earth Dave Grohl was playing drums for a band that wasn't Foo Fighters. I love those moments of when you discovered Nirvana. For my daughter, it will be standing in a lighting store on a Saturday afternoon, bored, and my husband and I made her stand there and listen to it and to take it in. And then, of course, we got into the car and went searching and, you know, played all of the old tracks. That's it for today. Thanks for listening. Take care, and we'll speak to you soon.